Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast series exploring all aspects of the criminal justice system with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor.
In this episode, I talk to Joanne Welsh, chief executive of the Oasis Project, who help women, children and families affected by drugs and alcohol. I talk to Joanne about the importance of a women-specific approach to substance misuse treatment and how the Oasis Project adapted their services during the pandemic.
I'm Joanne Welsh and I'm the CEO of Oasis Project.
And Jo, how long have you been at Oasis Project and what is it exactly?
I've been at Oasis Project a long time. I've been there for around 13 years. And Oasis is unique within the UK in that we take a women-specific approach to substance misuse treatment. So we were set up by a group of women who felt that their needs were not met in mainstream drug and alcohol services. So very much kind of a grassroots organisation 25 years ago. And we have a kind of whole portfolio of services that sit around those kind of that women's substance misuse kind of aim. So we have a creche for babies from birth onwards, and we have therapeutic services for children and young people who've been affected by parental substance misuse. We have services for sex workers. We deliver some specialist interventions for parents, both men and women, whose children have got child protection plans or involvement with children's services as a result of their parent's substance misuse. And we provide some services for people with complex needs. Oh, and we also work with women who've had a child removed in the past as a result of safeguarding concerns.
You said earlier that with the women that you work with, that their needs weren't being met. What do you sort of mean by that? Can you paint a picture of kind of what that means and then what that might look like operationally for you?
Well, I guess the most important thing to note as a starting point is that women are outnumbered in drug and alcohol services by men 3-1. So they kind of end up having a kind of focus on men's needs. And where you see that quite often is when you're thinking about people who are involved in crime. So quite often people get into treatment because they've been picked up through a criminal justice route. And we know that women's offending is not the same as men's. But in terms of our kind of model of supporting, having a women-specific building and a trauma-informed approach, the vast majority of the women we work with will have experienced domestic and sexual violence, either as adults or children or both. So in order to kind of do some of the work that's required to kind of help you recover from substance misuse problems, I would say a prerequisite is that women feel safe, that they're able to be vulnerable, they're able to talk about some of their past that's perhaps led them to using drugs and alcohol, and some of what's happened to them while they've been using. And I would, you know, really advocate for it, it's not especially a safe space for women to be doing that with men who are also in early recovery. You know, we know some things about men with drug and alcohol problems, but we also have to sort of think about it, it's bringing together men and women who are both in early recovery. And I don't think that's a good model for treatment services. And I guess just more practically, we know a lot of the women that we work with are single parents and often don't have a lot of what we would kind of call social capital. So they don't have a lot of family support. They don't have a lot of resource that might help them perhaps care for children while they access treatment. So there's just a practicality as well around childcare support. So we tried to kind of think about those practical issues that impact more on women and just have a whole kind of lens in which we look at things through, which is women focused rather than the default position, which is a men's focus.
Is there an argument to say that later on down the line that the groups can be mixed, or does it really depend on what's happened to those women in the past and whether it's appropriate? Does it always have to be quite bespoke?
I mean, there is an argument, isn't there? I mean, I guess, you know, one argument is that, you know, people live in the world where men and women in general have to mix together. I mean, one of the things that, you know, people in early recovery are kind of vulnerable to is some of the work is not just about stopping using drugs. It's about looking at a whole way of kind of being. And a lot of that is relational based. A lot of it is about kind of positive friendships and how you navigate those. And, you know, we all know, don't we, that relationships are difficult and they're difficult to manage. And when relationships are kind of going wrong, you know, that's potentially a trigger for like using substances again. So there potentially is kind of, you know, positives about being in groups together, but there's a lot to kind of think about around those relationships and a lot about how you think about when people are ready and a lot about thinking around what the kind of impacts might be if people kind of sometimes what gets talked about is like fixing your feelings with other things, like rather than getting to the root of what your problems are and noting that in the past you probably fixed them with drug and alcohol. There's a potential temptation to fix them with new relationships that then, should that new relationship go wrong, then, you know, leads you kind of quite vulnerable to sort of relapsing. We bring a particular women's perspective to that, but I suppose it's also worth knowing that, and we're not a 12-step or abstinence-based organisation, but it is worth noting that the 12-step fellowships like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous also kind of have a principle that men support men and women support women. So although their meetings are mixed, if you're looking for a sponsor, the fellowships will say you have a sponsor of the kind of same sex. They don't advocate kind of early mixing. And there's a bit of a kind of slightly jerky thing that goes around the fellowships about the 13th step. So, you know, there's 12 steps in recovery with the fellowships, AA and NA, etc. And people talk about the 13th step is having a relationship with somebody else who's in the fellowship. And, you know, somebody said, yeah, we have women-only groups, so we don't have to do the 13th step.
Right. So you mentioned the women-specific building. What do you mean by that exactly?
So it's a women-only space. We have an all-female staff team. And so all the women who are delivering this, all the staff who are delivering the support are women. And the building that we work from is women-only as well. I guess just to add to that, though, because on occasions, you know, I meet other services who do sort of say, oh, yes, we've realised we need to do something and we're going to have a women's group on a Tuesday night. But I suppose there's a whole kind of approach and training and a kind of value base around working with women that isn't just about saying, let's do something for the women on a Tuesday and we'll let them come through a back entrance and we won't have any men in the building. It's much more about a whole approach and an understanding of what issues women face that are kind of different to men. And I mean, I think most people would agree that women who use drugs are much more stigmatised than men. And I think you see that particularly around parenting. So quite often men who've had problems in the past with drugs and alcohol could kind of, you know, brush that off as a bit of a misspent youth, or, you know, when they were a bit of a lad. But it's very difficult to kind of frame a narrative around having lost your children and you know, being seen to be somebody who wasn't able to care for their children.
Yeah, and do you find that most of the women that come to you, are they the primary carers of children overwhelmingly?
Yes.
And they still have the children with them, do they?
So now we do have a specific program that is for predominantly women, although we do deliver it to a few men. So we have a specific program we deliver to women whose children are open to children's services. So that accounts for quite a lot of our work, because we get referrals in that way. And they, by and large, do have their children with them. But we also do have a sizable cohort of women who don't have their children living with them. And I guess when you think about the fact that people can stay in treatment for a really long time, that we've got people who their drug use and their needs in general have become much more chronic. So they may have lost their children, and in fact, then their problems become worse because of the impact of that loss as well. So they'd already often had a history of trauma and neglect and abuse, and then they may well lose their children. And, you know, it doesn't take, you know, anybody with a great deal of understanding to realise that then has a you know, further kind of negative impact on them and their chances of recovery.
Yeah. And what sort of drugs are you seeing the women particularly taking, and how has it changed maybe over the last couple of decades? And then subsequent question to that would be, how long do you have people in treatment for with you, and what's the optimum sort of time?
So the kind of drug that most people in treatment, men and women, would be in treatment for is heroin. But that is pretty much based on the fact that that's how services are very much seen. So, you know, and it's probably more of a driver for people to access treatment. You know, if they have got a heroin problem, they will experience kind of physical withdrawals, so may well be motivated to access treatment as a route to get opiate substitute, like methadone. I mean, methadone's the one that everybody knows. So that's often a bit of a push factor into treatment, in a way that the other drugs perhaps don't have that push factor, and they're just not seen. I think people who have are dependent on other drugs perhaps don't see substance misuse services as being somewhere that they fit particularly. I mean, I guess the other thing to say though about heroin use is it generally goes alongside polydrug use. You don't generally just see somebody who says heroin is my drug and that's all I use. And there's often, you know, use of benzodiazepines as well, other kind of misuse of prescription drugs, and then, you know, some use of crack cocaine as well amongst that cohort. I mean, there's probably a whole kind of hidden cohort of people who are misusing prescription drugs and painkillers that
right.
would never kind of think about approaching a treatment service for.
And do services reflect that or not really?
Do they reflect
polydrug use?
People do understand the kind of complexity of substance misuse. Now, what I can say, because the report was launched last week, is there's recently been a report undertaken by Professor Dame Carol Black over the last couple of years that's looked at issues in treatment services in this country. And I'm pretty sure it's a quote from Dame Carol to say that treatment services are on their knees. So whilst I would say to you, you know, we do take a holistic approach, and we like to look at, you know, people in the round, their mental health, what's going on for them with other aspects of their health and social care needs, housing, etc., that has to be framed in the context of, you know, a decreasing amount of funding over the last 10 years, an increase in demand and an increase in things like homelessness and poverty. So there is a kind of, you know, we know a lot about what works. We know how to treat people well, but we haven't necessarily had the resources over the last 5-10 years to deliver that kind of really effective model of support that we know would increase people's chances of recovering and having a meaningful, healthy life.
Right. And we always know that money is sort of one aspect of it. And we hear a lot on these podcasts, actually, you know, we know what the problem is. We know what the answers are. It's just me trying to get to a place where we can sort of action those sort of solutions, I guess. So if money's always an issue, that's one thing. What are the other things that are the big issues facing your sort of area of expertise?
I'll just backtrack a bit, actually, because you did ask me as well about, you know, what are the things we see the most of in treatment? And of course, the other thing that is probably half of what we see women present with is problems with alcohol. And that is hugely on the rise. And I think we've seen that as kind of cutting much more across you know, the whole kind of society. So, you know, that's not really that much of a surprise, is it? Alcohol is freely available and not stigmatised. So we certainly are seeing that. And that would also be borne out with the children that we see for therapy as well, that they're probably half kind of living with parents with alcohol problems. So the money...
So if money is one of the big challenges that always face everybody when they're talking about, you know, how they could change things, what are the other things that, you know, if you had that magic wand, what would you like services to look like?
Well, I can't resist the opportunity to say around money, we don't really need the magic wand, do we? Because, you know, the majority of women in prison will have drug and alcohol problems. And what do we pay for a woman to go to prison? About £56,000 a year, which if you gave me £56,000 for one woman's drug treatment, you know, it's just an extraordinary sum. I can't even put into kind of words what a significant difference that would mean if that money was in treatment rather than in prison. But yeah, there we go. We're creating more prison places, aren't we? So
well, exactly. Yeah. Which slightly flies in the face. What about accommodation? What's the issue around accommodation? Because I also realise that some women might have a roof over their head, but it might not be a safe one, or certainly not a place that you can get better in.
I mean, housing is variable across the country, really. I mean, obviously in Brighton and Hove, we have real problems around housing. And that does result in a real feeling of insecurity. And, you know, I guess just those kind of pressures to be dealing with life and not the best conditions to be trying to recover from substance misuse in. So we talk about, you know, increasing people's social capital. So looking at things like, you know, positive kind of friendship networks, positive kind of support from the community, which is often really lacking, often because people have become estranged from their family and friends because of their use or because it wasn't ever there in the first place. You know, we do need to kind of remember that lots of people who we treat, see in treatment, have also been through the care system as well. So they, you know, they didn't necessarily have that positive kind of social network to start with. There's definitely something that sometimes also feels quite controversial, but I don't think it is around, particularly for women, around kind of positive social roles. So work, volunteering, you know, that there are routes for women out of treatment. A woman said to me years ago, you know, I used to be a single mum who stayed at home, had no money and used drugs. And now I'm a single mum who stays at home with no money and don't use drugs. So there needs to be something like positive that is put in place. It can't just be, I gave something up. There has to be kind of, and that often is kind of quite a challenge. To think like, what might that be? You know, often women have spent, they've gone from school to a relationship to a child, and not had that sort of opportunity for self-determination or self-actualization. So we do cover things within our structured treatment programs. We deliver psychosocial interventions, and some of that is where we talk about relationship support, and we deliver some other kind of interventions alongside our core program. So we deliver Mellow Parenting, which is an attachment-based parenting program. And we've just been delivering, with funding from Public Health England, a parental conflict project, which is a sort of new emerging kind of field that looks at kind of not domestic violence level relationship support, but very much kind of how do you resolve conflict in relationships so that you can be kind of a better parent. We do a lot of work that is about women getting in touch with who they are and what they want, and thinking about, you know, what somebody might be offering to them in a relationship and whether that's what they want. And I think it sort of relates a little bit back to what I said before, which is perhaps if you've got other positive relationships in your life and more of a positive identity, and you know, you feel like you've got other outlets, the relationships don't become quite so important.
Yeah, exactly. And is your organisation residential or not?
No, we're not residential, no. Funnily enough, over the years, we've kind of gone backwards and forwards about residential. There are some good kind of residential options, actually, in Brighton. We're quite fortunate in that there's a couple of other charities who have sort of good provision around residential support. And it's, you know, it's been quite a difficult model over the years. There have been some women-specific residential treatment options that have kind of gone by the way because it's quite an expensive resource and they've not been utilised as much as they could be. It will be interesting because the report that I just referred to, the Dame Carol Black report, just talk about an increasing need for residential rehab and for more kind of inpatient detox as well. So a greater role for the NHS, who've kind of retreated from drug treatment over the last kind of 10, 15 years.
And is that due to sort of just huge growing demand? I mean, because I suppose the NHS can do so much, can't it? But then actually, can it be picking up all these specialised areas, and should they be doing that?
I mean, this kind of comes down to kind of what lens do you see substance misuse problems through? Do you just see it as it's a chronic illness? And if it's a chronic illness, why is it not being picked up like we deal with diabetes or cancer? And, you know, that's really interesting to start to think about the stigma that is attached to substance misuse, because in no other area of health would we tolerate people dying so young from something that we know is treatable with so little focus and attention when we know what interventions would make a difference. But we as a society have tolerated an increase in drug-related deaths over the last 10 years with seemingly kind of no focus on that at all outside of, you know, people who it is very much their focus. And, I mean, even the kind of launch of this report last week, I don't think it was covered at all on the mainstream news.
No, I have to say I didn't see it being talked about anywhere, and I'm a fairly ferocious consumer of the news.
Yeah, and we're talking about a huge social issue. We're talking about people dying very young who've already experienced a lot of disadvantage. We're talking about, something that has an impact on serious organised crime, violence, children been taken into care, yet there's very little focus. And that seems to me really clearly because it's about stigma and blame.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask what the reason would be to sort of duck it and not talk about it when it's, you know, problems with homelessness. But as you say, it's not just the low socioeconomic groups that run into trouble with this. This is a classless problem. It's just in the upper classes. It might be champagne and cocaine, and then it might be something else when it's sort of on the streets. So I wonder whether it's just because it's so normal and so, I don't know, so common. Is that why it's being ignored? Or is it too much of a problem for the government to actually deal with?
I mean, although addictions cut across all of society, I mean, you do see kind of quite often people who are at the very high end have problems with addictions, don't they? And of course, you know, people in music business and, you know, film industry, we've seen drug-related deaths in that kind of cohort. But predominantly, it does affect disproportionately people who are already disadvantaged. And I think there's a huge amount of blame that goes along with it, that people are seen as kind of engaging in something that they choose to do. You know, they've made a poor choice, as opposed to they are experiencing a chronic health issue. So I think that's, you know, that's at the root of it, really, that people are very stigmatised, that it is seen as something that people should be blamed for.
And what's your opinion on sort of the substitute drugs like Subutex and methadone? Is it ethical to sort of park people on sort of methadone? Or what's the view on that these days?
I mean, if we look at drug treatment and supporting people with addictions very much through that sort of lens of public health and health and health inequalities, there's a real role to play around kind of harm minimization, supporting people into treatment, providing some stability in their life. And methadone and other opiate substitutes have really got a role to play in that. They do make a really significant difference in cutting down things like bloodborne viruses, risk of overdose, just introducing a bit more stability, bringing people into contact with treatment services. We have got a lot of people in this country who have been on opiate substitute prescriptions for a long period of time. And the evidence kind of says that, you know, there is an optimum amount of time to be in treatment, and that's probably about 18 months to 2 years. There are some people who would argue that having a prescription for the rest of your life has a lot of health benefits, and it shouldn't be looked at any differently to how other chronic conditions are managed by medication. As I say, we're not an abstinence-based organisation, but I don't think that most people, when they come into treatment, have you know, that their kind of ultimate goal is to be on a prescription for a long time. But I think if we are going to kind of optimise people leaving treatment off any medication and not kind of using, then we need to kind of put a lot more intensive support in at an early stage when people present as being very kind of motivated and wanting things to change. It gets much harder the longer a problem's gone on for, and the more people feel like I've kind of done treatment. But there's health benefits all the way along, really, from having a script of what you know, a medication where you know what it is that you're getting. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting because politically there are also a lot of opinions around treatment and you know, you do see that to some extent in other illnesses, don't you? There's a slight kind of blame attached to people who are obese, and there's a bit of a blame attached then to type 2 diabetes, and did people bring that on themselves because they've got an unhealthy lifestyle. When you look at a lot of illnesses, there's an element of kind of behaviour that went along with it, including things like, you know, skin injuries and sports injuries.
Absolutely. But do you find with the sort of, you know, with the chronic stuff, you know, whether it's chronic obesity or chronic anorexia, well, anorexia is chronic, but you know what I mean? You know, it comes back to what we talk about in One Small Thing, my organisation all the time, which is, you know, what is actually going on? And I notice on your website, it says a similar thing, treat the person, not the problem. Because, you know, obviously what someone's presenting with is one thing, but then actually what's going on inside them, they might not even know themselves. And it might have been a trauma that happened to them so young that they don't remember and they can't articulate it. And I think I would imagine that that's the key, isn't it, with any of these services, to try and get to that point, that where something happened.
Yeah, I was reading something yesterday that talked about, it was about children and, you know, risk to children, and it talked about the underlying issues. And I think they were reading the underlying issues as substance misuse, but I was almost thinking, what's the underlying issue for the substance misuse, which is often kind of early trauma and neglect and, you know, everything. So the underlying, it's interesting how far you go on the underlying, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm always amazed at how there's a lack of going back so far when it's like, well, the problem is the drug problem. And it's like, no, what is causing the drug? You know, and it's amazing to think that services still just stop there and just say, well, that's problematic behaviour, and don't sort of say, why is that problematic behaviour actually there? Because it strikes me as though that's quite a sort of obvious thing to do. But and what led you into this type of work? Because, you know, it's always interesting to hear how and why people do the things that they do.
So I'm a nurse. I still am a nurse, which people often find that kind of, they can't quite grasp that you can be a nurse and working in a kind of senior management position. I trained as a nurse in the late 80s. And then I've always kind of worked, I moved to London and worked in HIV nursing when people with HIV were still kind of very ill, sort of pre the effective drug treatments. So I've always been kind of drawn to areas of health around health inequalities and perhaps where there's been quite a lot of stigma and prejudice. And I've kind of, you know, I've done other things in the interim. I've worked in sort of more policy areas in healthcare and health improvement type roles. But I like working with people, you know, even though I'm CEO, the creche is underneath my office. I see the children come in, I know some of the children's names, and I can sort of see when people are doing, you know, doing really well, and that's really nice to see. And I mean, I didn't, you know, feel like I had a burning desire to work in a women's organisation until I did it, and now I feel even more passionate about you know, the need for women specific services and what women can deliver when they work sort of together, and, you know, challenging the kind of status quo in some ways and being an advocate for people who often are not advocating for themselves. You know, I mean, I've had that said to me over the years, kind of, well, women don't particularly want a women only service. Which, you know, I would imagine the vast majority of our women are not ever going to be out campaigning saying, get us a women-only drug treatment service. But it's also kind of people don't really know what they need either until they've received it.
Exactly. I was just going to say that. Sometimes you're not always in the best position to know what's good for you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, then people really, a lot of women, you know, say things that are slightly backhanded compliments, like, oh, I never thought I wanted to be with a group of women. You know, I didn't think I really liked that until I came here and I've realised what I've got from sort of sharing, being with other women who are parents and have faced a lot of judgment. And
yeah, and I wonder whether it works the same for men, in a sense that I imagine the single sex male groups would work better when maybe they're not I'm not saying that all men show off to women, but there's just that different dynamic, isn't there? That might creep in when the opposite sex is in the room. And I would imagine they'd be more successful.
I wonder whether it's easier for the women when they're together in a group to be vulnerable than it is for the men to be vulnerable, even if it is just them. I suspect that's the sort of positive thing about being female, that there is an ability then to sort of, yeah, share things and be vulnerable that perhaps isn't there for the men.
How have things been for you during the pandemic? We're now sort of a year and a half in, aren't we? And have you been able to keep your services going, or how has that manifested for you?
Yeah, so we kept our creche open throughout. So, because we realised right from the start that our families would be under so much extra pressure. So we kind of, the creche kept going. All our children's therapeutic services, we pivoted kind of overnight, either by phone or digital, and according to kind of like the children's living circumstances, but also their developmental age as well. So some children didn't have their own bedroom. So, you know, some children are only five. They can't really do a telephone kind of therapy session. But we just tried to make sure that everybody had something that would be supporting them and just picking up really on the tensions that were there for families. And some of it was really scary. You know, we had a lot of staff who were working at home and were also single parents who were dealing with people who were suicidal, people who were kind of literally at the end of their tether with children. But we, you know, the staff team did an absolutely amazing job. They really did. I had staff who, you know, took food parcels, walked around Brighton delivering food. We were really fortunate in that we were successful in a bid to Barclays really early on, which allowed us to get a huge amount of digital tech to distribute to our client group. So we were able to sort of distribute lots of tablets and some laptops and phones and data, because we knew that lots of our families would be digitally excluded. So that was great to be able to do that, so that then we could have groups via Zoom. We did assessments by telephone. And I suppose the sort of saddest thing about it all is we saw a huge increase after the first lockdown ended. We saw 300% increase in new alcohol presentations.
Wow, 300%. And is that common, would you say, nationally, or do you not know? Because you're talking about the people being referred to you, right?
Yeah. I don't know how much it is. I think generally in the media, there's an acceptance that there's been a deterioration or an increase in problems. And I guess just, you know, all of us living through that, there was such a lot of kind of comedy, you know, sort of, ha, 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 let's get the wine out, you know, homeschooling kind of, which is a bit of a bugbear we've got in general about the whole kind of why mummy drinks, gin o'clock type merchandising that's like, you know, you're going to buy your mum some card for Mother's Day. You know, that's kind of, ha, 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 mummy with a, you know, I even noticed it on Sunday night all around the football, that there seemed to be a general consensus that everybody on Monday morning would be hungover.
Yeah, and that no one would be in work, and that, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a bit like this sort of, you see it with violence against women, and then if you go back down the spectrum of violence, you're talking about everyday sexism and the sort of misogyny and the kind of sexist jokes, and it's like, well, that's harmless, isn't it? It's all just a bit of banter. But then, of course, when you get to the more extreme end of things, it's usually those men who have got to that extreme end. It started with the stuff on the lower end of the spectrum, and it's really interesting then when you start putting that lens onto other problems. And it's the first time I've really thought about it with alcohol, because you know, I did the same thing. I was like, my God, I've got three children that I'm like homeschooling and I'm doing a job and I'm doing a master's and where's my gin? You know, and you do, and you talk to your female friends about it particularly, and it's like, oh, did you have a drink? You know, again, it's that sort of, it's so normalised in our society, isn't it?
But it's become normalised quite quickly, hasn't it? Because it wasn't that kind of normalised in the 70s that mums needed a drink at 5 o'clock. I mean, certainly there was a lot more of a drinking culture around men, wasn't there? But there wasn't that kind of gin o'clock and that's why mummy drinks. This is all kind of quite a new...
Yeah, that's an interesting one to ponder.
I mean, we've been doing a project, which is a national project as well, in Brighton and Hove around trying to improve support for children of alcoholics. And one of the things that's come up a lot there that I have kind of talked about quite a lot is luckily COVID's ended this, but all our staff who've got children in kind of quite early year schooling have talked about presence of alcohol at PTA events. You know, why is there alcohol in schools? You know, why is it if you go to like a child's nativity play that there's alcohol there?
Yeah, I've often thought about that because you're usually driving home as well.
Yes.
So it's even weirder because, you know, yeah. with my children, I've thought about exactly the same thing. And so I say there's so many non-alcoholic beers and drinks on the market. I've always wondered why we don't have just non-alcoholic beers and non-alcoholic cocktails on sale, because that'd be much more useful, because 100% of people basically at that event are driving.
Instead, we're telling children, aren't we, we can't sit through a nativity play without a glass of Prosecco.
Yeah, interesting. Really important sort of to be thinking about all those messages.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Well, listen, it's been so fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.